Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. And now let's take a trip north to the state known for its scenic mountain landscapes, its mountains, its shellfish, and its Yankee no-nonsense sensibilities. Writer Ann Beatty captures much about the state of Maine in her new collection of short stories, The State We're In, Maine Stories.
In fact, a Portland Press Herald writer says Beatty, quote, expertly renders the subset of Mainers she's writing about. And that's no small compliment from someone who also refers to Beatty as one of the summer people.
Ann Beatty is with us in studio to talk about her work. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So you've had stories published since the 1970s, many in The New Yorker. You've written 8 novels, 9 collections of short stories, and a trademark of your stories has been that many of them are told through characters' dialogue. The State We're In is your first collection in a decade. Can you describe it?
The State We're In focuses on a teenager named Jocelyn who has gone to stay with her aunt and uncle and to attend summer school while her mother has surgery, although actually the mother's carrying on with her boyfriend and recovering very well from the surgery. Thank you very much. And although the stories are not exactly linked, they do sort of revolve around the town that Jocelyn would have been in when she was with her family.
And Jocelyn writes from this sort of outsider perspective. She's a 17-year-old girl, so she would be a bit of an outsider anyway, but she also refers frequently to this belief that all the adults are lying and that things are going on behind her back that she doesn't completely understand. I mean, what is it about that voice that you wanted in these stories, do you think?
Oh, I think the skepticism was part of it because you always get that with teenagers. I also think that she's particularly outspoken about what she does think. She's not going to be criticized for it. And her aunt and uncle are fairly sympathetic figures, though they're very different from one another. But I think that I started with Jocelyn in some ways because I don't think it's all that hard for us to get back to that point of being a teenager when we could really just let loose with our skepticism.
Yeah. And do you see yourself a lot in Jocelyn and in the struggles of Jocelyn?
I do.
Yeah. How so?
I'm very skeptical.
Because of the skepticism. But she was also struggling to write essays in many of the stories. Was it the writing as well? Was it the fact that maybe she didn't do that well in school and she felt misunderstood? Were those things personal for you as well?
Well, there's also a teacher who's referred to often in here that she sort of hero worships, really, but she doesn't want to let on how fondly she feels about her teacher. But I think I can understand it from both sides. I mean, I have been a student and I've been a teenager and I've also been a teacher. I taught until a few years ago in college, and I was very amused by this idea of how would people think about magical realism, for example, if they only encountered it briefly and they were only 17 years old. I mean, the teacher sees it from one perspective and idealizes it, and then Jocelyn sees it in a very different, blunter way.
Right. But there's also, there are other stories that are not just about a teen's perspective on life. You also, but a lot of women's perspectives. It seems like a lot of the stories are told from the perspective of women.
Yeah, strangely enough, I didn't realize until I looked at what I had written in Rough Draft and I realized, wow, this is just overpowering. These are narrated by women. They are the focus of the stories, and they themselves often tell stories within the course of the larger story.
Right. Is that unusual for you?
That I would write that many that quickly and especially not be conscious of doing it is very unusual.
That quickly? Most of these written in one summer in Maine, is that right?
In Rough Draft, I have to stress the fact that some of them were really worked over and several were thrown away entirely. Okay. But yes, over one summer in Maine.
So was that a different process for you to write that quickly?
It was.
Typically, how long would a collection this size take you to, if you have such a thing as a typical length of time for writing like that?
A couple of years,
couple
2-3
years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think it was about these stories that made you get through them so quickly?
I'm not really sure it was these stories, to be honest with you. They came at a time in my life when I had left my teaching job at the University of Virginia, so I was totally out from under. I was back to being a freelance writer, which is what I've been almost from the beginning of my publishing. So I was out of the academic world. I didn't have to read 40 and 50 page short stories any longer by my MFA students. And in a way, I think I was still sort of protesting that great length that stories seem to fall into now by wanting to write sharper, clearer, more direct and shorter stories myself.
Well, you know, your writing's always been described as sort of minimal, but very inspirational, and it does seem to connect with a lot of young people today. Do you find that? And is that different from when you first started writing in the 70s?
Well, I think one of my most popular books remains my first novel from 1976. That was Chilly Scenes of Winter, and very often that's what younger people talk to me about. I mean, that's what at least introduced them to my work.
And why do you think that is?
I think that it was very much like a film in a lot of ways. It was written in the first person present, and it was as though something was happening right in front of the reader's eyes, and it had a kind of immediacy that people connected with. And also, I would hope that there's a sense of humor both in that book and in the stories that are in the state we're in.
We talked about the dialogue as well and telling the stories with a lot of dialogue and the characters actually telling the story in the way that they speak. What does this technique do for your storytelling, and has that changed?
Well, I think the effect that I hope that it will have on the reader, I mean, that's a difficult question to answer, but I'm certainly hoping that, again, you will feel that you have, that you're seeing these characters in close-up and that you have the ability to move in close to them, because it's almost like an overheard conversation on the street or in a restaurant or something like that. It takes the pose of unfolding in the moment. Of course, the writer is going to edit that and can put in any number of bon mots or anything like that after the fact, which we don't really get a chance to revise in our ordinary speech.
Was there something about Maine and the small towns of Maine that inspired you as well? While you personally may have decided that this was a time that you were no longer under so many obligations and you could write freely, was there something about Maine as well that you said, I need to write this and I need to write it now?
Well, I have to be honest, I didn't feel that. I didn't know what I was up to when I started writing. I didn't even mean to write a collection of stories about Maine. So that was a surprise to me, too, that in number I had that many in rough draft at the end of the summer. But I would say that Maine is a very diverse and enormous state, and I wouldn't pretend at all to speak for the state. I live in southern Maine. I'm pretty much equidistant between Portland, Maine, and Boston. And that is, you know, the town I live in tends to be pretty much year-round people.
Even though you were called a summer person.
Well, I didn't call myself that. I mean, I've lived here for 25 years for at least 6 months a year, so.
Yeah. I know at one point in one story, the one Silent Prayer, mm-hmm. that's a lot of dialogue as well between a man and a woman. It's a lot about relationships, marriage, life in Maine. And at one point, the woman in the story says, and I'm going to read a quote here, "We're really sorry the lobstermen can't afford to live in town anymore, and it's really too bad about all the businesses going under, or maybe the greenhouse stays open because they sell orchids, which have become the new azaleas around here. And sure, the economy is effed, but we all know about French wines and we fly first class and we think about effing tennis." What are you saying about the characters here, about the people there, and about class, really?
I'm obviously saying something about class because that's absolutely true, as we all know, that a lot of the working people have no way to live in any proximity to their jobs, and the land is being sold up to developers and, you know, things become more commercial. I mean, it's no different really in Maine than it is, I think, nationwide. I just got back from Kentucky, which I'd never seen before in my life, 2 days ago, and the sprawl was very similar to Charlottesville, Virginia, where I used to teach. It's very similar to Maine, where I'm living now. So there's a kind of anonymity and a kind of sprawl that is inevitable. I think I have to take note of it, but I'm not a sociologist and I'm not here to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. One person I read described your collection as many of the characters in it accepting a general sense that their lives are being wasted. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't see that, honestly. It seems that a lot of the characters realize that they have to make compromises within these stories, or deliberately the stories catch them in an odd moment. The story you were quoting from before is all dialogue between a husband and wife, and really what she's very anxious because he's leaving. He's going on a business trip, and her silent prayer is that he live. But, you know, the way we do sometimes when we're very anxious about what's happening with somebody we love is to fight with them and to think that we have some sort of control over the situation because we're going head to head with them. But really, it's a kind of lamentation in that story. I particularly don't get it, that kind of capsule view of the stories.
Hmm. I'm wondering if you could read a passage for us, a passage from the story Duff's Done Enough. The very end of that story, I think, is an interesting passage. Would you mind reading that?
Sure. The whole world's full of stories. I never doubted that. Every writer will tell you the same thing. It's next to impossible to find the inevitable story because so many needles appear in so many haystacks. Most writers spend their entire careers, those who are lucky enough to have them, considering endless piles of hay, praying, just praying, that a needle will prick their finger.
So how do you think the needle came to prick your finger here for this collection? Where did the inspiration come from?
Well, my husband had taken a 3-week trip with his brother, and I must have been a lot more nervous and sad about that than I was willing to let on to myself. That's a partial answer anyway.
So when we were talking about the dialogue in the other story, in Silent Prayer, you understood that dialogue, that fear, perhaps, of your husband not coming back. And maybe that was part personal as well.
It is, and the stories are all about a sense of loss, what's absent, not just the positive, but the negative space.
All right. Well, Ann Beattie, who will be speaking at the Harvard Bookstore at 7 tonight, about her new collection of short stories, The State We're In, Maine Stories. And thanks for coming in. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.